court is ready to hear oral argument in Star Telegram Incorporated versus Honorable Walker.
May it please the court, Mr. Williams will present argument for relatedness. Mr. Williams has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Thomas J. Williams, counsel for relators. This mandamus proceeding arises out of an invasion of privacy case pending in the court of the respondent, Judge Jeff Walker, which has been brought against the relators by the real party in interest, a woman identified only as Jane Doe, in the proceedings in the trial court. She has sued the Star-Telegram and the individuals for invasion of privacy as a result of two articles that were published in the Star-Telegram concerning a rape in which she was the victim. The articles did not disclose the woman's name, but the genesis of her suit is that enough information about her was disclosed that it gives rise to a cause of action.
Did you know the woman's name at that point?
Your Honor, all of the evidence we have indicates that the woman who wrote the article at the time, who is one of the individual relators, Tong, did not know the woman's name at the time. We believe enough information was available that it could have been determined. There is a motion for summary judgment pending before Judge Walker right now, which he has under advisement, that speaks to that issue.
Do you know the woman's name now?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does the record reflect when you learned?
Yes, Your Honor, it does. After, of course, the case began, we served interrogatories on her seeking her name as well as other information. She filed a motion for protective order and a motion to seal records. Hearings were held in December and January of this past year. In March of 1991, the woman's assailant went to trial in the Criminal District Court No. 4 of Tarrant County, and her true name was used in some of the filings filed at that time in a motion in limine in the charge of the jury, and most importantly, she testified in person using her real name. Sometime shortly after that trial.
So is that when you learned it?
Yes, Your Honor. During
the trial?
Well, actually, Your Honor, somewhat after the trial had concluded.
Before the criminal file was sealed.
That's correct, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. After the trial in the criminal case, but before Judge Walker had entered any written protective order, we became aware of what transpired in the criminal case. In the course of checking it out further, we became aware that her name had been used in the indictment, which had been returned back in October of 1989, before the civil suit was even filed. Although that was there and was a matter of public record, to anyone who might have seen it, the evidence indicates that no representative of the Star-Telegram actually obtained personal knowledge of that at the time. But after the criminal case went to trial, it was made known. That was brought to the attention of Judge Walker. That was the focus of the motion to reconsider his protective order that we filed, because at that point he had not actually signed any written protective order. He conducted a hearing on July 2nd of this year. A statement of facts from that hearing is before you. It was stipulated that the records were filed in the criminal case, were open to the public, available for public inspection, and the records, the indictment, the motion in limine, the court's charge to the jury, all reflected the woman's true name, and that the woman testified in person and was identified in the course of that examination by her true name.
Is it correct, Mr. Williams, that there is no record of the January the 10th hearing?
Your Honor, that record is not before you. The January 10th hearing was the hearing required by Rule 76A of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. Procedurally, what happened in the trial court was the plaintiff initially filed just a motion for protective order asking for alternative relief, either that she not be required to answer the interrogatory at all, or alternatively that some restriction be imposed on our ability to disseminate that. A telephone hearing was held. Apparently, she then felt that she wanted more relief than that, because on December 26th, she filed a motion to seal records under 76A. That was the focus of the hearing on January 10th, and of course the court denied it, so the denial of that sealing is not before you.
All right, and there is not anything before us, is there, in the course of this proceeding concerning the adequacy or the fulfillment of the requirements under Rule 76A?
It's not in the record before you, but we are not bringing forth any complaint on that point. They did comply with the procedural requirements of 76A.
And
yes.
There's no separate appeal pending under 76A-8.
That's correct.
Of the decision. Now, but wasn't it following the January the 10th hearing that the motion for protective order that the judge decided to enter or to grant the motion for protective order?
Your Honor, initially in December, there had been a telephone conference hearing in which he had verbally indicated to counsel that he was willing to grant some sort of protective order. At the January 10th 76A hearing, as the record reflects, he denies the motion to seal under 76A. He verbally tells counsel that he would still be willing to enter a protective order, and he does make a docket entry. He still signs no order. He makes a docket entry that says protective order granted, discovery not to be filed but maintained with restricted access. But that's all that happens on January 10th. The focus of the January 10th hearing was their hearing, was the hearing that they were required to secure for purposes of Rule 76A. And of course, because he denied that relief, we have not brought forth any complaint on that.
What evidence is there in the record to support the good cause requirement for entering a protective order?
Well, Your Honor, we maintain there is not sufficient evidence in the record because once her identity became a matter of public record over on the criminal side, there could not be good cause. No evidence could be brought. Now, whether there would have been good cause in the absence of public record, I think is a very serious issue. The woman did not testify at any of these hearings. Other than representations and arguments made by counsel, there was no evidence of what the cause was for the protective order.
Was there any testimony at the January the 10th hearing?
No, Your Honor.
If the prosecutor erroneously uses the victim's name when she's indicated her preference that a pseudonym be used, the prosecutor is subject to a Class C misdemeanor. So once the name is divulged, is it your contention that it's fair game for the media?
Yes, Your Honor. That absolutely is our contention. And the case in which the Supreme Court of the United States has so held, it seems to us, is the Cox Broadcasting versus Cohn case, which we cite and discuss extensively in the brief. Cox said that the press cannot be sanctioned for publishing truthful information contained in open public court files. And it went on to say that if there are privacy interests at stake here, what the state has to do is take steps to see that information is never put in the court's public file in the first place. And that's what our statute
is. Class C misdemeanor is subject to, what, a $200 fine?
Yes, Your Honor. Our legislature enacted Chapter 57 of the Code of Criminal Procedure, and Justice Carney, you're correct. The penalty may not appear to some to be very severe. It is only a Class C misdemeanor. Perhaps the woman could argue that there's an implied civil cause of action. I'm aware of no case where that has been addressed one way or the other. But for better or for worse, that's what the legislature chose to do. And I think the legislature was careful not to restrict the public's ability to go to those files and read them. And if an error has been made by the prosecutor, the only burden falls on the prosecuting authority.
Is it your contention that once the name is revealed that there is no competing interest in favor of the victim to that of First Amendment rights of the media?
Yes, Your Honor, or that if there is such a competing interest, it is so clearly outweighed by the public interest in having access to public court documents.
Well, is there any competing interest in the privacy interest of the victim?
Actually, Your Honor, I think that what the Supreme Court is saying in the Cox case is that once it becomes in the public domain, in these public court files, there is no competing interest that can overcome that.
What if that appearance in public records is inadvertent? There's no cure for that except to attempt to convict the offending party of a misdemeanor?
Or perhaps the victim could argue that there's an implied civil cause of action. As I said, I'm aware of no case that addresses that.
But once it leaks out, that's it.
That's right. And the reason, Justice Heck, is while that may appear unfair to a victim who makes this election and has her instructions disregarded, either intentionally or negligently. It's because there's a greater interest, it seems to me, that we cannot impose on the press or any other member of the public the burden of having to go behind those files and ask those kinds of questions. If a reporter or any other...
Why should the press be the beneficiary of an inadvertence?
Because it's not just the press, first of all. It's the press or any other...
Public?
Or, yes, Your Honor, or the public. Because once the information is disclosed in public court files, we have adopted as a philosophy in this country and this court interpreting our Texas Constitution as it has agreed, that it's available for inspection. And we cannot put the burden on the citizen to go behind that public file and ask, well, you know, the real name is included in this indictment, but maybe it was a mistake, maybe I ought to go check it out further. Once it's there, it's available. We make it available to any citizen who comes into the clerk's office and wants to see it. And if error has been made, the only remedy is what Chapter 57 of the Code of Criminal Procedure authorizes.
If the appearance was limited to a very short period of time, a few minutes or hours, would that make a difference?
I don't think it would make a difference if the person whose conduct was a question became aware of the identity in that short window. I think you could have that situation, and in fact, you have it here, although it was after a very lengthy period of time.
Do you concede that there's no way to determine the woman's identity now from the criminal record?
No, Your Honor, I don't concede that. Certainly, as identity is defined in this protective order.
Her name is not disclosed.
Right.
In the criminal record.
The only thing the criminal judge did in that motion after the fact was order her name and home address to be expunged. He did not speak to all of these other characteristics that are included in Judge Walker's definition of identity.
Under these circumstances, would you agree with me that the protection given to a rape victim is not a meaningful protection?
No, Your Honor, I don't think I can agree with that. I think we've got to assume that the state follows the instructions when these victims make this election. Apparently, at the time of the indictment in this case, that didn't happen. But when we get to trial, everything that is happening at trial is with her consent. When she got up and testified at trial, and the first question was, state your name, and she stated her true name, she was doing that voluntarily. That was no error of the prosecutor. She knew exactly what she was doing.
Mr. Williams, you have made reference in argument a moment ago to the Texas Constitution. In addition to the rights that you assert under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, you also say that this protective order is violative of the Texas Constitution, do you not?
Yes, Your Honor.
And isn't it your contention that there is a case from this court, Ex Parte Tucker, that appears to be in point on this issue?
That's correct, Justice.
Could you elaborate on the effect of Ex Parte Tucker?
Yes, Your Honor. Of course, it goes without saying that this court can interpret Article 1, Section 8 of the state constitution, which is the basis of Tucker, more broadly than the Supreme Court of the United States has interpreted the First Amendment. And of course, in Tucker, the facts were that a trial judge in a civil suit entered an order that would be analogous to what we now call protective orders, ordering one of the parties to the suit not to vilify one of the other parties. A complaint was made that the party had violated it. The party was held in contempt. Tucker, of course, is a habeas case. And the Supreme Court said very clearly, relying on Article 1, Section 8 of our state constitution, that it tolerates no such restraint. That if there is a remedy, there's punishment after the fact, either punishment for contempt in that case, or perhaps more analogous to our situation, a civil suit for damages. But the Supreme Court in Tucker, very clearly relying on our state constitution, said no such restraint on speech could be tolerated under any circumstances. The other case we cite, of course, is Hite versus Bill Mowbray Motor Company, where the man wants to hold up signs in front of a used car lot saying that the car lot sold him a defective car, a lemon was his word. The car dealer seeks and obtains a temporary injunction. This court, relying on the state constitution, held that unconstitutional, said there may be a remedy in damages later, but just the fact that speech is tortious is no basis for restraining it in the first place. And that's what it seems to me we have here. If we were to go out and publish...
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from... from
May it please the court, Mr. Haney will present argument for the respondent.
Your Honors. Coming up with the arguments that we're going to present on behalf of the respondent, Jane Doe, the real party in interest in the underlying litigation, who is a part of, we represent the plaintiff. We think there's two reasons why we don't have to get to the constitutional issue of whether or not the protective order operates as a prior restraint on the freedom of the press. We think, A, that mandamus is not really the proper remedy in this case, and there's some reasons why we feel that's appropriate. And B, we don't believe that they're entitled to the equitable relief of mandamus because I think there's two equitable doctrines that are applicable in this case that would preclude them from getting having the right to obtain that equitable relief. First and foremost, we don't believe, as to why mandamus is not a proper remedy, we don't believe that the realtors can show that they are have been harmed by the judge's order. They have argued that this is outrage as a prior restraint that prevents them from publishing information that is part of a public record somewhere. They have testified on the record, and we have set that forth in what we filed with the court here.
Well, let me ask you to pause right there. Is there any debate about that? Isn't it uncontested that this is, at this time, a matter of public record?
You know, I think I would debate that issue on this basis. That I think there was an opportunity, a window of opportunity, if you will, while it was a matter of public record. I believe the trial court, the criminal court, sealed that record and expunged her identity and some other identifying facts about her from that record. I think it is no longer a part of that public record.
So something can become a matter of public record, and then through the action of a trial judge, it can cease to be a matter of public record.
It's a difficult argument. I will acknowledge the question, and I know it's a difficult argument. I don't know what happens if they grab that information during that window of opportunity, withdraw it, and then that record is sealed. I don't know how that information should be treated.
It is uncontested that she testified live in a courtroom, perhaps not unlike this one, in public.
But she did so, you know, he says she did it with her own consent and of her own volition. I believe she did so, but it was a limited consent that she gave him. She agreed to do that on the basis of the prosecutor's representation to her that she would achieve this protection subsequent to the criminal trial, and that during the trial they would try to protect, by excluding people from the courtroom, protect her identity in that fashion. And also they asserted to her that they would enhance her ability to obtain a conviction of her assailant if she used her real name at the time of trial.
But that consent, surely, assuming that you're correct about that and that there were limitations on her consent, how does that bind a member of the public or of the media who happened by the clerk's office that day and saw her name in the indictment?
I don't know that it does, Your Honor.
Does that mean that at this point you could not obtain this same relief against another member of the public or the media that you have obtained against the Star Telegram?
If I'm understanding your question correctly, we might could, but it might involve the assertion of an entirely new cause of action against that person for the invasion of that same privacy right that we believe was abrogated by the...
Well, to be specific, if a major network said, we're going to run this story tomorrow night, and we're going to use the lady's name, is there any way you could stop that story from appearing before it did? Obtain the same relief that you obtained against relators in this case.
Again, I would just ask you if you could rephrase the question for me. I'm not understanding what you're asking.
If a network, for example, said we're going to run a story tomorrow night about this case, we're going to use the lady's name.
That's correct.
Which we obtained from the criminal records while the case was public. Could you stop that?
My efforts would be to seek an immediate injunction and to try to prohibit them from using that information. I think ultimately
you
have to take back the
balance. Prevail on that, though?
I'm sorry?
Do you think you should prevail on that?
I believe I should prevail on it. For when you balance the competing interests involved, you've got substantial privacy rights, I believe. You've got an articulated state policy, which is to protect the identification of victims of sexual assault. You've got a significant injury that occurs to the lady when this information is disseminated about her. My lady's life will never be the same.
Isn't that kind of prior restraint presumptively unconstitutional?
No, but prior restraints are not
per se unconstitutional. There's a general prohibition against there being prior restraint, but there are certain prior restraints, as you're probably aware, that are valid prior restraints. You know, if the...
Counselor, I think we concede that what you just said, but I think what we're all having a difficult time, I certainly am, wrestling with, is how something, once it has entered the public domain, can then have this restraint invoked on it. When a person, regardless of the circumstances, voluntarily relinquishes that degree of privacy, that element of privacy that you're talking about, how can they can then reassert it? I think once it's entered the public domain, the damage is done. How do you recover from that? And how do you hold someone liable for
part of the argument,
exploiting that, if you will?
Part of the argument that you raise is something that addresses really the underlying lawsuit. What's happened is, you know, to say that she waived some right at that point in time or waived some protection that she already had by not participating in the record, I think is an incorrect analysis of what occurred in the case. And I'm saying, giving this a long way around to get back to the answering your question. What happened in that case is she comes in as a victim of rape. She comes in before the police officers. They start analyzing, you know, investigating the crime. She is traumatized both physically and emotionally at that time, and she is not really afforded an opportunity to make some election to have her name expunged from the offense report, which is also public record.
I'm trying to get the chronology down here as well. Without going down the dates and sequence of events.
Rape occurred in September of 1989.
Rape occurred, and the paper somehow got a copy of the police report.
Their representation, and I think this is what's contradictory to one of the representations.
I just want to get the facts. Okay. Down. They somehow got a copy of the police report.
That's correct.
They
were searching
the government. They published the circumstances of the rape. Did they publish her name at that time?
They did not publish her name. They published, in our opinion, sufficient facts about that. And I was saying he was, you know, he lifts the North Pole, drives a sleigh pulled by eight tiny reindeer. There's enough information to identify my client.
They published the circumstances of the
That's correct.
Of the rape. And ostensibly, at least arguably, your point of view, sufficient facts and details so that the victim could be identified from the story itself.
Yes, Your Honor.
By strangers, I would say.
Yes, Your Honor.
Subsequent to that, in October, early October, the victim asked that the Jane Doe denominator be used.
That's correct.
In all public proceedings. Subsequent to that, the district attorney's office had an indictment issued by the grand jury using her real name.
That's
even
correct.
Even after she had invoked the criminal procedure protection.
That's correct.
So the DA breached.
I don't dispute that.
All right. Then the victim filed suit against the newspaper, and subsequent to that, filed for a protective order. Then the victim filed a motion to seal. Motion to seal was subsequently denied. Protective order was granted. Subsequent to that, the victim agreed of her own volition to go into the courtroom to allow her name to be used in public proceedings, public records, and to testify under her own name. She agreed to that. The trial was conducted. The newspaper, in view of the fact that she had agreed to this public disclosure, then moved for reconsideration of protective order. The state, subsequent to that, moved to expunge her name from all those public records. And subsequent to that, the trial court entered the protective order. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I just want to be sure we
That's
have
correct.
All this.
And that chronology, I think, is relevant to one of the reasons why I don't think you have to get to the constitutional issue of whether or not the protective order operates as a prior restraint. I believe, you know, mandamus is an equitable remedy. I believe there's an equitable doctrine of latches that's applicable in this case. The representation of the realtors is that they only obtain the information to identify my victim by name at the ones that came out in the criminal proceedings. I think that's an incorrect assertion of the facts. I believe defense, and one of the allegations that made in this case is that they obtained an unprotected copy of the original offense report, which included her name, which included her address, the type of vehicle she drove, and a lot of other information, pertinent information about her. I believe they had that in their possession as early as September of 1989. The original issuance of the protective order and the docket entry was made in December 10th of 1990. They don't file their motion to reconsider the protective order until May of 1991, and then we don't have a hearing until July 2nd, which is, you know, just natural course of events. But then they don't file the writ of mandamus until roughly 9 months after the original protective order was entered back in December.
Mr. Haney, the letter coming into possession of the information, it relates to publication of the information.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Mr. Haney, let me ask you a question. I understand that your argument that we do not need to reach the constitutional issues in this case.
That's correct.
Assuming that we do.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do we have to overrule Ex parte Tucker and Hayek versus Bill Mowbray Motors? Or, if you don't have to overrule these cases, how do we distinguish them?
I don't think you can, to be frank with you, I think if you reach that level of analysis based upon existing case law, I think the protective order is overly broad. I think it doesn't fit within the gambit of existing case law.
You're conceding then that the...
I would say that it's outside the gambit of the Reinhart decision, which is the U.S. Supreme Court decision addressing protective orders, which said that it must be bound up just in those matters gleaned through discovery.
But that didn't involve state constitutional analysis.
No, it did not.
And so what you're saying is if we reach the state constitutional issue, you lose.
I'm not conceding that. I think ultimately the court's going to have to evaluate, once again, a balance against of competing interests.
Well, let me ask you about that, because quite clearly there's a fundamental right constitutionally based in our state constitution of privacy that this court has recognized. We have a strong commitment to free speech in our state constitution. But in this particular case, hasn't the legislature said when those interests come into conflict in the very real way that they have here, with all of the trauma that you mentioned with reference to a rape victim, which is certainly very real, that in that situation, the burden of protecting the privacy of the victim is placed with the same authority that is responsible for prosecuting the person who caused the crime in the first place, and that is the local district attorney or law enforcement authority, and that if there is an invasion of privacy, the place to look for a remedy is against that official rather than against someone who releases the information, be it a newspaper or the town busybody.
If we're saying today that there, because something appears in a public record, that the press is free to go out and use that information without any restriction, without any restraint, I think is an abhorrent interpretation of the Constitution. I think in certain, I'm talking about a certain limited sliver of information, the identity of a victim of sexual assault. I think they ought to be entitled to some type of protection. I can't believe that the drafters of the Constitution ever intended for that type of person within this broad analysis of having the right to observe governmental proceedings, ever intended for that type of information to be set out to the public to the detriment of all those victims.
But you have no case authority in support of that position and a rather considerable amount of authority to the contrary, don't you?
That is correct, Your Honor.
With reference to the non-constitutional questions in this case, in order to get the protective order that you obtained, you had the responsibility of establishing that there was good cause for the entry of that protective order. Did you offer the trial judge any live testimony in order to satisfy your good cause burden?
No, Your Honor. The original protective order was issued at a telephone hearing. Because of the exigencies of the case, it was kind of fitted in, if you will, within the trial judge's window of opportunity to have this matter heard before the discovery deadline.
So the trial judge entered a protective order without any evidence to support
other than the representations of counsel.
Just the argument of counsel.
That's correct.
And then on the motion for reconsideration, by that time a considerable period of time had gone by, what live testimony or other evidence did you offer to support good cause under Rule 166b-5 at that time?
The evidence that we submitted was, again, the argument of counsel, as well as we entered in some certain exhibits, which were, I think, before the court, which is the election to file a pseudonym, as well as the protective order that was entered in
the
criminal case.
There was no evidence other than the exhibits that are in the record, and all of that hearing consisted of argument of counsel rather than the presentation of evidence through live testimony, deposition, or affidavit. Is that correct?
That's correct. Your Honor, if I may address something, you know, something that we seem to lose sight of is the problem that the victim has with the publicity stemming from this type of action. Absent that...
This type, are you referring to this present civil action or the criminal action?
The civil action, the criminal action, either one. You know, you leave these victims absent taking some effort to protect them. You leave these victims out there in a position where they're afraid to assert their rights for fear of the attendant publicity that will be associated with a trial. It's an embarrassing and humiliating and shameful experience for them in the first place, plus the fact that the other members of the public have to find out about it.
Mr. Haney, if you were writing the opinion for this court, what would you say, and you have to reach the constitutional issues, what would you say about Ex parte Tucker and the Hyatt versus the Mobley motives?
In light of the present reasoning of the court and its applicability to this factual circumstances, I think you'd have to overrule. If on this narrow basis, the victim of sexual assault, and again weighing the competing interests.
If you are wrong about relator's right to use this information publicly, as it has been presented in this proceeding, how does that impact the merits of your invasion of privacy action?
Well, if what their representation is correct, and if the case law along these lines is actually correct, what we've essentially done is waived or destroyed any right for invasion of privacy that these victims may have. And I don't know that that is something that we're ready to do. Or
so
I hope we're not ready to do that.
So by granting the writ, we will have effectively decided the merits of the underlying case.
If you get to the constitutional issues, and I don't know that you have to. I think there are some equitable principles, unclean hands and latches that would allow this protective order to remain effective, and I would ask the court to not get to that issue. If there are other reasons to not warrant the extension of the court's reasoning to the constitutional.
Are you familiar with our recent opinion of last week, Walker versus Packer?
No, I'm not. I'm not familiar with that decision. But if I could clarify some matters on as far as this the chronology, I go back to the argument about the doctrine of latches, merely to assert that at the time the initial protective order was issued, the judge articulated at that time a broad enough order which included information outside the scope of discovery. Otherwise, why would they have brought the motion to reconsider after her name was used in the criminal proceeding? And I say that to say that at the time that the original docket order was entered in that protective order, they already had access to a public record that contained her identifying facts about the victim that they could have objected to. And yet they still waited this long period of time before they filed a motion to reconsider that entry of that protective order. One other matter I think is relevant to this cause of action, or what we're discussing today, the protective order was ultimately presented to the court and sat down with opposing counsel, myself, and the judge, and we went through that order on a line-by-line basis and registered our objections at that hearing. Opposing counsel had an opportunity to hand in the drafting of that order, and now they're objecting to that drafted order. And I it's not something I articulated in my brief, but I think it's relevant to the analysis in the case. Are there any other questions?
Anything else? Thank you.
Are you familiar with our case last week of Walker versus Packer?
Yes, Your Honor.
And under those guidelines articulated in that opinion, how do you think you're entitled to a writ of mandamus?
Because, as I understand the court's holding last week, the court said that to the extent the trial judge has to make a factual finding or weigh some balancing test, if you will, perhaps the trial court's discretion should be adhered to. But the court said last week
that a trial court has no discretion in determining what the law is or applying the law to the facts. Thus, a clear failure by the trial court to analyze or apply the law correctly will constitute an abuse of discretion and may result in appellate reversal by extraordinary writ. That's what we have here. If this had been the type of order like the Washington court entered in Seattle Times versus Reinhardt, where it was limited to information learned in discovery that otherwise would not be available, and if the trial court had gone through the balancing test the trial judge followed apparently in the Reinhardt case, perhaps under Walker versus Packer, mandamus would not be appropriate. That's not what we have here. What we have is clear evidence put before the trial court, and Justice Dogger, going back to the question of what was before the judge on July 2nd, while there was no live testimony, it was stipulated by the parties and accepted by the court that all of these instruments had been filed in the public record in the criminal case and were available for public inspection, and that the woman testified live under her true name. So given those undisputed facts before Judge Walker, he had no discretion. And to use the language of Walker versus Packer, he had no discretion to determine what the law was. The law is clear. Under the First Amendment, as interpreted by the United States Supreme Court, and under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution of the State of Texas, as interpreted by this court.
Counsel, if we so hold and grant the writ, doesn't that mean the merits of the underlying case have been effectively decided in your favor?
No, Your Honor, I don't agree with that. And the reason is because the first public filing in the criminal case did not come until after the articles that she's suing us on had been published. If the indictment had been returned first, and that had formed the basis of the articles, then I think Cox Broadcasting versus Cohen would be dispositive of the underlying case. What happened here, though, is the articles appeared within a short time after the incident. The indictment comes about 3 or 4 weeks later.
The first articles did not list her name.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So they merely described her in a manner in which she contends the public able to identify her.
That's right.
Her name did not appear until when?
It never has appeared in the Star-Telegram to this day.
Respondent complains that when you're suing or getting sued by a newspaper who has a bigger public voice than you do, the newspaper may try to use that voice to gain advantage in the civil case. What's your response to that argument?
The response to that would be true if this were limited, as the order in Seattle Times versus Reinhardt was limited, to information that we come by in the course of discovery and do not otherwise have access to. But actually, Your Honor, that's the reverse of what has happened. What has happened here is because she's suing us, she has had the protective order as a vehicle to get what is in effect an injunction against the Star-Telegram from publishing public information. And any other citizen, newspaper or otherwise, that may come into that information lawfully is free to do so, but we're not, only because she is suing us. So I don't see that as a reason to deny the writ. If we had a Seattle Times versus Reinhardt type order limited to discovery, information that is not otherwise available, that might be different, but that's not the facts of our case.
Is your irreparable injury mainly the fact that this is a constitutional deprivation?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are all constitutional deprivations the irreparable injury that would allow an immediate relief from the state's highest court?
I'm not sure they all are, Your Honor, but certainly a deprivation of the right of the press to publish truthful information that has been disclosed in public court filings is such an irreparable injury. I think Nebraska Press Association versus Stewart is probably the United States Supreme Court that has the clearest language on that, where they talk about how a prior restraint on the coverage of criminal court proceedings is an immediate and irreversible sanction, and only extraordinary relief can set it aside. We certainly have
not. Why be gone at the First Amendment or and not the Fifth Amendment and Fourteenth Amendment takings clause? Or I'm just trying to understand where the line is.
Your Honor, I don't know that I am prepared to say that all such constitutional issues would rise to the level of the irreparable injury. Some might be of such a nature that there would be an adequate remedy by appeal, for example. But we don't have that in this case. But certainly in any event, it seems to me that where it is, if the facts are what we have here, there is such an irreparable injury.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
That concludes the argument in the final cause. All the foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will now adjourn.
The audience will please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.